Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present Rabbi Michael Lerner, who assesses the possible consequences of President Bush's endorsement of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip while making several Jewish settlements in the Palestinian West Bank permanent. Michael Schwartz, Professor of Sociology at the State University of New York, who examines the roots of the Shiite uprising challenging the US occupation in Iraq, and Tara Thornton, Executive Director of the Military Toxics Project, who discusses the negative health effects attributed to depleted uranium munitions, both on soldiers and civilian populations. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report finds that major diamond retailers are not following an industry program to stop the sale of so-called conflict diamonds that have fueled bloody civil wars in the African nations of Angola, Sierra Leone, and the Congo. An investigation by the British-based group Global Witness in four major U.S. cities found that high-end stores like Bulgari, Cartier, and Harry Winston did not respond to inquiries about conflict diamonds or the program to prevent them from reaching stores. U.S. retailers such as Bloomingdale's, Macy's, and Saks Fifth Avenue also failed to reply to questions. Global Witness then concluded in its report, Broken Vows, released at the annual meeting of the World Diamond Council, that compliance with the industry's 2002 Kimberley process was abysmal. The Diamond Council also came under fire for lax coordination in monitoring the flow of conflict diamonds. According to the website OneWorld.net, the Kimberley process was endorsed by the World Diamond Council to create import-export controls on rough diamonds, and it created a certificate to document a diamond's point of origin. Yet major diamond retailers have failed to follow through on this commitment to human rights. As Global Witness campaigner Corinna Gilfillan observed, some of the largest U.S. and international retailers are only paying lip service. Gay Republicans are at the epicenter of the new culture war over the definition of marriage. At the Log Cabin Republicans' mid-April convention in Palm Beach, California, many white, middle-class gay Republicans were clearly angry with President George Bush for endorsing a federal constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. In the 2000 election, an estimated 1 million gay and lesbian voters pulled the Bush-Cheney ticket, including 60,000 gay voters in the decisive state of Florida. Officially, the Log Cabin Republicans who endorsed Bush in 2000 have not yet endorsed a candidate for 2004. Right now, their focus is on stopping the anti-gay marriage amendment from getting out of Congress. In several swing states, the gay Republican group is running TV ads featuring Vice President Dick Cheney, saying in 2000 that people should be free to enter any kind of relationship they want to. Some gay activists are upset with all the media attention given to same-sex marriage. Chris Bowman, a political consultant from San Francisco, thinks it's diverting focus away from the fight against AIDS and the need for anti-discrimination laws to protect gays and lesbians. The timber industry in the Pacific Northwest got an unexpected windfall when it requested a review of the decade-old policy protecting the habitat of the northern spotted owl. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in charge of the review under the Federal Endangered Species Act, outsourced the review to a private firm under pressure from the Bush White House. The winning firm was Portland, Oregon consultant Sustainable Ecosystems Institute. According to Forest Magazine, one of the consulting firm's key officers is Steve Courtney, a former staffer with the National Council of Pulp and Paper Industry. And soon after moving to Sustainable Ecosystems, Courtney had his work underwritten by the Pacific Lumber Company, a harvester of redwood forests in Northern California and foe of dedicated eco-activists. An investigation by the Seattle Times newspaper revealed that the firm got 44% of its revenue from the timber industry. Sustainable Ecosystems' website boasts of corporate sponsors and partners like Weyerhaeuser, Boise Cascade, and Potlatch. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service faces an April 20th deadline to complete the study on the spotted owl. In the late 1980s, the endangered owl was the focus of conflict in the Northwest timber wars that resulted in the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan crafted by the Clinton administration. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. We'll be right back.
In a severe blow for efforts to restart stalled Middle East peace negotiations, President Bush endorsed Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip while making several major Jewish settlements in the Palestinian West Bank permanent. In an April the 14th announcement at the White House, President Bush, with Mr. Sharon at his side, also rejected the right of millions of Palestinians and their families to return to homes and land they had left during the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. In making his pronouncement, Mr. Bush angered Palestinians by taking away their right to negotiate these critical issues themselves. The agreement, which Mr. Bush described as historic and courageous, was viewed by many nations around the world as an abandonment of international law, which dictates that Israel must return to its pre-war 1967 borders. But just 3 days after the Bush-Sharon announcement, Israel's assassination of Abdel Aziz Rantizi, the leader of the militant Palestinian group Hamas, further infuriated Palestinians and prompted calls for revenge against Israel and the US. While Ariel Sharon, backed by President Bush, claimed the second assassination of a Hamas leader in a month as self-defense against terrorists, many nations around the world condemned it and expressed fears that the action will only accelerate a deadly spiral of violence. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of the progressive Jewish magazine Tikkun, who assesses the possible consequences of President Bush's endorsement of the Sharon plan and the Israeli policy of assassinating its opponents.
This is a major historical change. The United States has always had the position that Israel would have to go back to the pre-67 borders. This is as major as Bush announcing a policy of preemptive strikes central to American foreign policy, to now say that boundaries of nations can be set according to the facts on the ground. What that means is that any nation can conquer land from a neighboring country and put their population there and then claim that that's where their real boundary is. It has to include the demographic realities on the ground. So this is horrendous. It's a horrendous precedent for the rest of the world, and it's horrendous for those of us who are seeking peace in the Middle East, who want an outcome that is both a secure Israel and a secure Palestine. It's part of the general deep distortion in the policies of both Israel and in the United States in seeking security through domination.
Rabbi Lerner, what are your fears for what happens next? The Palestinians seem all but resigned to the idea that hope for a negotiated settlement is dashed. And at the same time, you've got cries of vengeance for blood in the streets of Israel from supporters of Hamas and even people who didn't support Hamas with the assassination of these two leaders.
I have no doubt that this will lead to more violence, but I think that you have to understand that violence is exactly what the Ariel Sharon types benefit from, because they then are able to point to the violence as confirmation that there is a need for more protection against the Palestinians. So in a way, taking the most provocative actions possible, for example, in killing Hamas leaders without ever allowing them to have a trial and defend themselves from the charges that they organized violence against civilians, this behavior produces exactly the results that give Ariel Sharon political strength in Israel. If, on the other hand, the Palestinian movement were to respond to all this by building a Gandhi-like or Martin Luther King-like nonviolent movement, I think that Sharon's powers would be weakened. But he takes provocative actions hoping to strengthen the voices of the most extreme elements in the Palestinian world.
People in the Bush administration, as well as, of course, representatives of Likud, Sharon's party, Likud in Israel, say that Israel leaving the Gaza Strip could jumpstart peace negotiation and will actually assist in reaching, ultimately, a peace settlement that will be good for both Israelis and Palestinians. How do you respond?
The idea that Israel has is to create essentially a Bantustan state, similar to what South Africa did when it gave the homelands to black people and said, here, you're going to have these independent states. But those independent states were surrounded by South Africa and by the South African army. In this case, Gaza is surrounded by Israel and by the Israeli army, even on the seaside by the Israeli navy. They have no freedom of travel. They have no freedom of trade. They are totally cut off. They're like one big ghetto. And by the way, it's not that big. The whole Gaza Strip is considerably smaller than the Bay Area of Northern California. It's a tiny little area. And in that tiny little area, there's going to now be control by Hamas, because Hamas, the force that will be able to claim that its violence produced this exit from Gaza. You see, Israel had the option of dealing and negotiating an end to the occupation, and thus showing the moderates, the Palestinian people, that moderates in the Palestinian world could achieve something. Instead, by unilaterally withdrawing and doing so in the face of acts of terror by Hamas, it gives new credit to Hamas's view and Hamas's claim that it's only violence that Israel understands.
Rabbi Lerner, what do you make of the presumed Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry's reaction here to the Sharon-Bush agreement to pretty much abrogate the right of return and to undermine the return to the pre-1967 borders in Israel?
He had a reaction. I thought it was like a squeak.
A squeak. Well, Kerry seemed generally supportive of the Bush-Sharon plan. What do you make?
Sure, Kerry seems to be committed to running on a strategy of Me Too-ism and being a Republican light. And, of course, I know that Kerry, in his heart, actually, on many issues, certainly on ecological issues, is not Republican light. He's a person of principle. But the way he thinks that he can win this election, apparently, is to play down any principled disagreements and just hope that the antagonism towards Bush will carry him to victory. I think that's a mistaken strategy. I don't think that it's going to work for him, and I think that it would be far better were he to articulate an alternative. But I also have a feeling that no matter, even if he did get elected, I think that he might very well be a captive of the voices in the Jewish and Christian right who insist that the United States should walk lockstep with the most right-wing governments of Israel, officially claiming that they're being pro-Semitic. But, of course, from my standpoint, there's nothing worse, nothing more anti the interests of the Jewish people than to support policies that are actually going to blow up in our face and, in the meantime, are undermining the moral and spiritual foundation of Judaism.
That was Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of the progressive Jewish magazine Tikkun. Tikkun is sponsoring a teach-in to Congress on Middle East peace in Washington on April the 25th to the 27th. Contact Tikkun by calling area code 510-644-1200 or visit their website at www.tikkun.org. Heavy fighting over the past month on two fronts in Iraq has resulted in the deaths of nearly 100 US soldiers and an estimated 1,000 Iraqi civilians and combatants. The American siege of Fallujah was halted after an uneasy ceasefire was brokered to avoid further bloodshed in the defiant city. Combat there has taken the lives of 600 to 700 Iraqis, many of them civilians. Negotiators attempted to reach an accord that would end the fighting if insurgents in Fallujah agreed to give up their heavy weapons. In southern Iraq, another standoff continued in the Shiite holy city of Najaf, where militia members loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have seized control, while 2,500 US troops surround the area. As in Fallujah, Iraqi negotiators are working to defuse the situation. The intensifying conflict in Iraq came as the newly elected Spanish Prime Minister Zapatero followed through on his campaign pledge by announcing the rapid removal of his nation's 1,300 soldiers from Iraq. In an indication of a further erosion of the US coalition in Iraq, the nation of Honduras followed Spain's lead and announced their own withdrawal of 370 troops. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at the State University of New York, who examines the threat posed by the Shiite uprising and the multiple challenges now facing the U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
I wouldn't want to understate the importance of the fight in Fallujah right now, but I think that in the long run, the insurgency in the Shia areas is going to be the real telltale struggle in Iraq. First, the U.S. announced that we definitely were going to stay in there no matter what the Iraqi government said after June 30th. In this very famous around the world, but not very famous in the United States, declaration by Bremer, in which he invoked the United Nations resolution saying that even if we were asked to leave, that the U.S. would remain there. And apparently, at least according to the New York Times, which had a very interesting article covering this some weeks later, apparently what they're doing is they're modeling the government they foresee after what's going on in Afghanistan. The American ambassador in Afghanistan is essentially the governor of the country. This is according to the Times a couple of days ago. And he operates as a kind of, not even a chief executive officer, but more like a chief operating officer. The daily business of the government is run by the American ambassador there. And this apparently is what the United States is envisioning for Iraq after June 30th, that there'll be a formal government. There'll be somebody like Karzai there, but the U.S. ambassador, who's going to be Negroponte, the current ambassador to the U.N., will have a 3,000-person staff, the largest staff of any ambassador in the world, and will run the country. But there will be a technical Iraqi government with sovereignty. Now, when this all became clear with Bremer's statement, there was a huge uproar, especially among the Shia, who were still struggling with the idea that as a majority they would end up with sovereignty. And, of course, Sadr was the most vocal and most militant about how unacceptable this was. So the U.S., seeing that the handwriting was on the wall, that this was going to be a confrontation and might well be a confrontation not just with al-Sadr but with the whole Shia community, apparently decided that they had to muzzle him. And that's when they first took away his newspaper, which, of course, only had a circulation of 10,000, but it was 10,000 to his most loyal followers. And that was his best method of communicating to his people, so they thought that would muzzle him some. And then they started going after him, first arresting one of his aides, but announcing that they were going to arrest him for this murder a year before, which he may or may not have been involved in. And then they began attempting to dismantle the Sharia courts, which in the South, you know, the two elements really that characterized those quasi-governments that existed in the southern cities were the militias, who were the forces of law and order, and the courts, the Muslim courts, which were operating in the absence of civil courts. And, of course, they weren't capable of doing everything a civil court might do, but they did a surprising amount of it. So they started moving on the courts and moving on him, and he apparently decided that he had to take action to resist this. Now, the really crucial question that emerged was, and the way the whole thing came down, is that in order to move against him and his people, the U.S. would have to take the troops that were sitting outside of cities and send them back into cities. So, in fact, what the militias did is they went to the police stations and they said to the police, okay, we're done with this charade, we're going to take over. And the police pretty much said, fine. Some of them were on their side. Some of them were not willing to fight for the coalition. And virtually none of them were willing to fight. So what happened was it was basically a peaceful takeover of the physical signs of authority, the police stations. In the meantime, the U.S. troops were outside the cities. So all this happened in a very peaceful way. There was virtually no violence at all. Now, it's funny the way the U.S. press has portrayed it, because you get this sense that there was some kind of a violent uprising, but it wasn't a violent uprising. In effect, it was a nonviolent uprising, of course, using the threat of violence if there was resistance. The Shia leadership immediately understood that what would happen in these cities is what's happening in Fallujah, and they intervened very forcefully to say, we don't want this to happen, and we've got a stalemate now in negotiations. It's not exactly clear what will happen, because the U.S. runs a double risk if they fight. If they go in the way they did in Fallujah, they will be just as brutal and it will be just as bloody as anything we've seen in Fallujah, because there's only really one way for the U.S. to fight these wars, and that is to just blow up the cities.
Is any government that Washington installs in Baghdad to act as a fig leaf, for lack of a better term, for the occupation in the years to come, will that government have credibility and viability?
Not anymore. They might have been able to pull it off had they started on a different tack a year ago. But now they've done it. There's no way they can install a government that's anything but a visible puppet, one that doesn't have the support of the Iraqi people. Now, it's entirely possible that they can succeed in doing that. but it won't be something that anybody in the world, except maybe Americans who don't read the back pages of the newspapers, which might be a lot of people in America, but everybody else in the world will know it's simply a puppet government in the United States, because that these events in Fallujah and in the South have definitively alienated everybody.
That was Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at the State University of New York. Read his article, What Triggered the Shia Insurrection, online at www.tomdispatch.com. Concern is growing over the health impact of depleted uranium, or DU, used in recent wars including Iraq, both on troops and on civilian populations in conflict zones. Despite little media attention devoted to the issue, the Military Toxics Project has been compiling data for many years about the effect of DU on civilian communities. The project works with people who suffer from elevated cancer rates and other health problems attributed to the DU production or contamination in their communities. The organisation collaborates with veterans groups who are extremely concerned about the health effects on soldiers serving in areas where DU is used. 4 of 9 soldiers from a New York Army National Guard unit recently returning from Iraq tested positive for DU contamination. The Toxics Project is also working as part of an international effort to ban depleted uranium, which is currently used by 23 nations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tara Thornton, Executive Director of the Military Toxics Project, based in Lewiston, Maine. She discusses some of the health effects ascribed to DU, how communities are fighting back, and the efforts now underway in Congress and internationally to monitor its effects and halt production.
We started working, we actually worked with some folks that did a report called Depleted Uranium Weapons at Home and Abroad, which really kind of highlighted the fact that these weapons, really throughout the whole life cycle, when they're, you know, when the uranium is mined, which is primarily done in the southwestern, primarily indigenous communities, to the enrichment of the uranium for use in nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons, to the production and manufacturing where they actually make the DU bullets and the shielding for the tanks, and to the test sites here in the United States where DU weapons are tested, that the whole life cycle has impacted the environment. There's been a lot of contamination around these sites, which still has not been cleaned up in many areas. There's been a lot of illnesses among workers, former workers at those facilities, and also in around the facilities, the communities, the neighborhoods that are adjoining those facilities. Depleted uranium is one of those issues that we've worked on since 93 with communities here in the United States that have been impacted by the effects of depleted uranium weapons.
What health impacts have been found among these workers or their families?
You know, in a lot of these communities, we're finding higher incidences of cancer, thyroid diseases, problems with kidneys, kidney damage. You know, there's been effects of neurological systems, and we also know that it is a neurotoxin and a genotoxic, which means that it can affect future generations. I'll give you an example around the Concord, Massachusetts facility called StarMet. It was an area where the DU bullets were made for use in the first Gulf War. And there's been extensive contamination around that site. In fact, it's now listed as one on the national priorities list. Some of the worst toxic sites in the United States are on this list. A lot of people know of it as Superfund sites. Now, this has gotten into the groundwater in that area, in that community. And they've found, because there is a cancer registry in Massachusetts, they've found increased rates of cancers in the communities around the StarMet facility. And this is something that's going on, like I said, throughout the whole life cycle of this of depleted uranium munitions. It's impacted the health of the workers in these facilities and also the area residents.
Can you talk about if any lawsuits have been filed or if those affected are seeking compensation, or do they just want the contamination cleaned up?
different communities have different strategies. But there are, around the facilities where the uranium was enriched, there's three uranium enrichment facilities in the United States. One is in Portsmouth, Ohio, another Paducah, Kentucky, and then Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is recently shut down. But those three facilities, they enriched uranium to use for nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. And that's where depleted uranium is actually stored. It's where it's created and where it's stored. There's over 1 billion pounds of depleted uranium outside these facilities. The former workers in those facilities have gotten involved in looking for compensation. Actually, under the Department of Energy, there has been, it's called RECA, Radiation Employment Compensation Act. And it started with compensating some of the uranium miners out in the Southwest, and then was extended just a few years ago to include former workers of nuclear weapons facilities. So the folks at those enrichment facilities now are eligible for, if they're sick and have illnesses that they can attribute to their work in these factories, they're eligible for compensation under RECA. However, there's a lot of drawbacks with RECA, and a lot of the former workers, I think there's a very limited amount of workers that actually have seen any kind of compensation because of incredible amounts of bureaucratic red tape that they have to go through to get that, to get the compensation. There's also a couple of things that are happening right now in Congress. There's a bill that Congressman Jim McDermott from the state of Washington has introduced called the Depleted Uranium Munition Study Act, and he's looking at doing much more investigation and studies on areas in the United States where DU weapons have been manufactured and tested, and also looking at doing epidemiological studies for the people around, not only in Iraq and the soldiers, but also civilians that may have been impacted around these facilities.
That was Tara Thornton, Executive Director of the Military Toxics Project. Contact the project by calling area code 207-783-5091 or visit their website at www.miltoxproj.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikatar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.